stopped working. It no longer inspires creativity. The irony is that I've written articles about stash busting, and I even created a Craftsy class about it. I've encouraged people to go through their stashes on a regular basis and cull everything that does not bring them joy. I praise that marvelous feeling you get when you love every skein in your possession. I'm a preacher who constantly grapples with her own faith, the psychotherapist who chose her field to try and heal herself. The fact that I'm sitting here now, writing about stash for an anthology of my own making, just underlines how complicated the struggle is. My knowledge of Buddhism extends primarily to the Dalai Lama's Twitter feed, but I do know that it's not good to cling to material possessions. We are of the nature to die. Everything around us is of the nature to die, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. No amount of yarn or books or old house keys will stop this. All we have is the here and now, and we must live richly in it. I'm not suggesting we renounce possessions, but the Buddhist monk Shunryu Suzuki does give a refreshing definition. Renunciation is not giving up the things of the world, but accepting that they go away. The universe has a built-in mechanism to help things go away. It's called entropy, and it's constantly at work, shifting our world from order to disarray, harmony to chaos. Entropy and time can force a tipping point with everything, with clothes or shoes or books or music or yarn, or even with alcohol, food, or cats. There's a tipping point of excess. You know when you've hit it. Left to its own devices, yarn longs to be in motion. I've witnessed this while making Clara yarn. I do it the slow way, building relationships with farmers, waiting months until shearing day, then waiting patiently for the fleeces to be skirted, then scoured, then sorted, then carded, spun, twisted, and skeined. Some yarns have been in motion for years before they're ready. Then, I unveil them to the public, and within minutes, they are gone. At first, I felt that old panic, the old devastation. Those skeins had been my companions for so long, and just like that, they were gone. And as we know, when they're gone, but they weren't. As I watched, the skeins took on a life of their own. Soon they showed up in people's Ravelry stashes and blogs and Instagram feeds and on their bodies as knitted garments. Some hopped from stash to stash, publicly traded on the open market like crude oil or hog futures. If these skeins continue on their ultimate trajectory, in the distant future, the garment will have been worn by as many people as could possibly wear it. The sweater will find its way into the garbage or a compost pile or a landfill. It's hard for a knitter to hear, but this step is essential for what happens next. We need that compost and that landfill so that we can grow more grass for the sheep to graze on so that they can, drumroll please, grow wool for Aunt Clara's next Christmas sweater. Perhaps there is no beginning and end to yarn, just a constant heartbeat of energy, a long chain of shifting shapes from lamb to landfill that started with the Big Bang and won't end until the next Big Bang. All we have, bringing back my inner Buddhist for just a moment, is the here and now, the yarn in our hands and on our needles at this very moment. That's our stash.
Spinning Stash by Jillian Moreno. I am a spinner, and my stash is monumental. I will never spin all of it, and I don't care. My stash means far more to me than just yarn to be spun. It makes me a more creative person and a better spinner. The act of stashing is a creative pursuit all its own. Ask any process crafter. Process crafters don't care if we finish. It's about the planning and the making. Between you and me, I almost never finish anything, maybe one or two projects a year. But that never stops me from planning and starting something new with the same manic glee that my dog greets me with after a few days apart. Just because I'm a spinner, don't think for one instant that I don't buy yarn or have a commercial yarn stash too. In fact, I still have yarn bought on my honeymoon in Ireland 20 years ago. It was before the big knitting boom of the late 90s made its way to the United Kingdom, and my husband and I hunted tweed yarn all over the country. We asked about yarn everywhere we saw wool, and we chased down every lead. Finally, we found the Donegal Tweed Mill, and it was as magical as I wanted it to be, which almost never happens. I got an impromptu tour and was invited to shop mill ends for a dollar a skein. We then had to hunt for a duffel bag big enough to get all the yarn home. We found it, army surplus and huge. This story illustrates not only that I know about the importance of knitting stash, but also why I'm still married to my husband after 20 years. I knit for years, even though I also knew how to spin. And then one day, I woke up and needed to spin again. It was soon after number two was born. I was still in that new baby haze, just trying to shower every day and have enough wits about me to play with number one when she came home from school. I'd known how to spin for 8 or so years by then, though I'd put it aside. But I woke up that day with a fierce need to spin and to make yarn. I got out my wheel, which had been waiting patiently, made some seriously ugly yarn, and haven't looked back. Spinning was all the things I loved about knitting, but with so many more options and decisions, so many more yarns to make and then use or admire. My spinning stash grew faster than my knitting stash ever did. It was like fireflies in the summer. You see one, turn and call, there are fireflies into the house, then look again, and they're everywhere. A spinning stash is much more complex than a knitting stash. It's like the first mother goddess. Everything comes from it, and nothing happens without it. You can't have yarn without the fiber. When I make my own yarn, I get to choose the fiber, the breed of the sheep, the type of silk, the flax, cotton, steel, or blend. I select or create the preparation, whether it's commercial top or roving, bats, fleeces to be washed and combed or carded, or locks to spin. I decide on the size of my yarn, the drafting technique, the number of plies, all to make the exact yarn I want for a project or an idea in my head. Then there's color. Color in the spinning stash isn't just about what you buy. There are natural and dyed solids, semi-solids, variegateds, and gradients that can be manipulated and combined in spinning in an infinite number of ways to create an equally infinite number of color effects. Each of these choices informs my finished yarn, and my stash reflects all of this boundless possibility. I have fleeces, top, roving, bats, smooth and wild, rolags, puni, several kinds of silk, and a raft of dyed fiber. That's my favorite part of my stash. That corner looks like the sky on the 4th of July, an explosion of color and a celebration of the talented dyers from whom I've bought my fiber. As a spinner, this thinking and decision-making happens before I ever knit one stitch. It's what keeps me excited about spinning and keeps me adding to my stash. I could never have too much fiber. I never felt the same way about commercially spun knitting yarn. In fact, I was happy to de-stash those skeins, giving them away to knitters who wanted them. My knitting stash was about acquisition. My spinning stash touches something deeper. Looking back, I realize I've always had stashes. I grew up in a not-so-friendly family during the 1970s, when no one used words like dysfunction, and no matter how haunted you looked, no one outside of your family could do much to help you. While my parents focused on their own sorrows and misery, I gathered things. For me, it was books and stuffed animals. The books let me know there were other places and people, a path out. The animals gave me something tactile to hang on to, literally. As I was growing up, I believed in myself and made a few important not always easy choices. I walked away from the people who hurt me or didn't support me, including my parents and lots of so-called friends. Then I walked, no, I ran toward people who loved and supported me in my life, my work, my play. Those choices allowed me to find joy and satisfaction in whatever calls me. I no longer gather things as a shield from the grief of my childhood. I still have a hefty number of books, and they still show me places and people, but now they are a celebration of humanity. The stuffed animals have been replaced with fiber, every ounce of which symbolizes potential, the potential to become yarn, and the potential to fuel my own creativity. I am a magpie, a collector. If I am interested in something, I want it, all of it. Tweed yarn? I want a skein of every kind I can find, and all the books about it, too. I use stash for research. I stockpile against trauma and tragedy, and to feed my curiosity. I am not a completist. Loads of fiber for stash's sake, nothing more, make me happy. A lot of my stashing has to do with what-ifs. What if I get snowed in? Want to start something in the middle of the night? Lose my job or have no money to spend on stash? Find it on sale? Get a discount? Find my favorite color? Find my favorite fiber? Encounter a wool shortage? Fear someone else might buy it? Realize that someone I know needs it in a snowstorm in the middle of the night? You get the idea, and probably have some similar anxieties. A spinner needs a stash that reflects the monumental potential in yarn. Add to this the what-ifs, the wild hairs, and the abject failures, and the need for stash just keeps growing. I am unapologetic about the size of my stash. It keeps me grounded. In it, I see possibility and the comfort of abundance. It is a reflection of me on a deep level. It's also filled with connections, not just the stories of what happened and who I was with when I bought a particular braid of fiber, but also the stories of the fiber and where it came from. The closer you get to the source, the closer you get to the people. Buy a braid of fiber produced by a commercial yarn manufacturer at your local yarn store, and you'll meet all of the wonderful people at your shop. Buy a hand-dyed braid from the dyer herself, at a fiber fair, and you'll meet the person who dyed it and possibly even sourced and processed it. Buy a fleece from a shepherd, and you'll meet the sheep, whose name is Lavender. Learn about the flock and shepherd, and possibly sit down and have coffee and cookies with her, and end up going back every year after shearing to pick up more fleeces. All of those stories and communities orbit around my stash. But what's most important to me about my stash is that it makes me more creative. A big stash allows me to have a fluid sense of creativity, a looseness that is very much like playing. It opens me up, unlocks things. The creative bit takes all the other pieces, the possibility, the abundance, the connections, and the actual work of making yarn, bundles them, and explodes like a glitter bomb. It gets everywhere. It makes me smile, and I can't escape it. My stash is the spark. Even if I haven't spun for days or weeks, even when I'm feeling dull-witted or anti-craft, I still spend time with my stash. It pulls on doors that have been locked, slides under the crack, and clicks them open from the inside. After an hour tossing my fibers around, I am revitalized for making yarn, yes, but for things well beyond that, too. My stash feels like an extension of me that I sometimes forget about. The part that plays, that connects things that don't seem to go, that experiments and makes things. Over the years, I've discovered some spinners who are actually intimidated by their stash. They're ashamed of it, confused or overwhelmed by it, stuck in ruts because of it, or just not really spinning happily from it. I want to pass along the feeling my stash brings me. Whenever I teach, I bring a duffel bag of fibers culled from my own stash, and I offer it up like bread starter. I dump its contents in the middle of the floor. The room goes silent. There is an instant tension, as when a terrier sees a squirrel. The students have laser focus. There is burbling excitement. They don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be good because there is a stash. We start with one or two fibers. I ask them to pick. They are always kind, never snatching, but they are focused. They grab what speaks to them. Some do exactly what I ask of them. Some need a little extra. There are always a few people who will boldly take more than their share. Some sneak it and hide it in their bag. I understand that need. Somewhere in their life, they didn't get enough. Let this be the time that they do. Then there are those who gaze at the pile. They take just enough. Maybe a little less. But they keep staring, and I know they need more. They're holding themselves back. They don't play enough. They don't give enough to themselves. Sometimes I give them extra, and when I do, their whole self smiles, and I hear, faintly, a sort of click. Something has unlocked. It is a visceral and amazing process. As we work, my students keep diving into the stash. I see them change. They are free and joyous. Concepts they found harder to get or didn't think they'd like come easier. There is lightness. They are digging in and instinctively playing, spinning differently. I know that they won't look at their own stash the same way when they get home. Since that fateful morning so many years ago, my number two has grown and is now in middle school, and number one is on her way to college. And my spinning stash? It's become big and messy, like Joanne Worley's uncontrolled laugh, spilling everywhere and bringing lightness and play into my life. And that's exactly how I want it.
Stash Changing Moments by Susan B. Anderson. I taught myself to knit as a teenager. Knitters weren't in my family, or even in my neighborhood for all I knew, so I learned on my own. There was no internet, and there really weren't any knitting books at the bookstore. It was a different time. I immediately fell in love with knitting, though, and I set out to learn everything I could about yarn, tools, and techniques. What I didn't know anything about, however, was stashing or collecting yarns. I would simply find a pattern, buy the yarn for that pattern, and then knit that pattern with that yarn. It was the only way I knew. After I'd been knitting for several years, I learned that my friend's mom, who happened to own a yarn shop in a quaint little city a couple of hours' drive from where I lived, was looking to retire and sell her shop. When she told me, my heart stopped for a minute. I wondered if this was supposed to be the next chapter in my life. The yarn shop was in a historic mill, which made it even more charming and enticing. The old stone walls, the nearby wooden walking bridge, the flowers, the creek that trickled by the backside of the shop, the huge rooms inside, and the shelves already chock full of colorful, squishy yarns. The whole scenario was pretty much a dream. I talked to my friend's mom and asked if she would consider me taking over the shop for her, and she said yes. It was all very preliminary, as I had small children at home, and a husband with a good job he liked, and we lived in another city. But I loved thinking about the potential of that knit shop. I arranged to visit the store, just to spend a day and hang out. While there, I learned a thing or two about knitting that would change my life forever. I walked in that morning, and was greeted by an attractive, tall, and friendly woman named Anne. Anne was knitting away as she introduced herself, working on a gray sweater of some sort with the ball of yarn tucked under her arm. I was fascinated right off the bat. She had worked at the shop for years. She made me feel comfortable, and we began to chat about knitting, as knitters do. I didn't even know any knitters at the time, and I basically had never talked to anyone about knitting. I was starved for information, and ready to get my fill of knitting talk with Anne. She asked me about my knitting. I pulled out a baby hat I was working on. I was at the decrease point on the crown, where it was getting too small to fit comfortably around my 16-inch circular needle. I had double-pointed needles with me, but I had no idea how to use them. I shyly asked Anne, who quickly showed me how the needles worked. Within a second, I was on my way. I was overjoyed. I asked her how she found time to knit during her busy days. She woke up at 5 every morning before her family got out of bed. She made a cup of coffee and would sit and knit for a couple of hours in total peace and quiet. I had honestly never thought about doing that. It was an incredible idea, similar to athletes training early in the morning. Being an early bird by nature, I took this idea to heart and have been spending the wee hours of the morning knitting in peace with a cup of hot coffee by my side ever since. The final topic that came up in our conversation was stash. I had never heard or thought of collecting yarn before. Anne told me about her stash of yarns, some lined up for specific projects, but most without purpose as of yet. It was this second type of stash that was new to me. She told me that she would buy yarns from different shops, yarn that was made in different cities or countries, and yarns that she ran across in her travels without any project in mind. I was completely naive about the concept of stash, but I fell in love with it. I left the shop that day with my head spinning about yarn and knitting and a whole new knitting lifestyle that I really wanted to dive into fully. We ended up not buying the quaint yarn shop by the creek. My husband got another job offer that was closer to home, and we happily moved on. However, my knitting was never the same after that visit. It became so much more. I started thinking about yarn and stash in a completely different way. I slowly started looking at yarns and their potential to become all sorts of things, not just one specific project. Thinking about stashing yarns like this expanded my intentions and my ideas about projects. Ideas swirled in my mind about designing with different yarns. It was a whole new world. I started to collect my own stash. Years have gone by since that brief yarn shop fantasy. My knitting life and stash have changed. I am now a full-time knitting author, writer, and designer. My life's work, besides raising my family, has become all about knitting, yarn, and that once missing stash. I have traveled to teach at yarn festivals, yarn markets, and yarn shops all over the country and beyond. While at these events, I often explore the cities and event markets and buy special yarn souvenirs to take home with me to remind me of that place and time. Needless to say, my stash has grown. I also have boxes and boxes of yarn show up on my doorstep from yarn companies, either to design with or to review. This is a pretty fun problem to have, and I'm not complaining. But over time, my stash got a bit out of hand. Every nook, cubby, bin, and drawer in my little house has been taken over by stash. Then something happened. I heard the fantastic knitwear designer Hannah Fettig discussing her stash on a podcast, and it struck a resounding chord with me. Hannah said she realized that her growing stash was stressing her out. She wasn't enjoying it any longer. Instead of dwelling on it, she packed it all up and took it to her local knit night. Hannah made a bold move and simply gave her entire stash away, saving only the few yarns she needed for current design projects. She described how an enormous weight of guilt and burden was lifted off her shoulders. Hannah's actions had a big impact on me. I, too, was feeling stress about my yarn stash, and something needed to be done about it. I wanted to shed my stash like a snake shedding its old skin. After being completely inspired by Hannah's brave act, I decided to try something similar. It seemed unavoidable. I started looking at my yarn collection in a new light, studying the skeins and thinking about what the different yarns meant to me. I devised a plan to sort my stash into four simple categories. Category 1. My desire to work with this yarn has changed. It has to go. Category 2. This yarn is for current works in progress. It has to stay. Category 3. These are special memory skeins from travels, gifts, or even virtual travel. I snagged a special skein online that I'd been eyeing forever from a British farm, for example. These yarns can either be saved or let go, but an immediate decision has to be made. Category 4. This yarn is appropriate for giveaways, on my blog, or for workshops. It stays. This isn't a universal need for most knitters, so I will leave it mostly out of this conversation. Caveat. One yarn type that I fudged a little was sock yarn. I am a sock knitter who tears through her sock yarn stash quickly, so I put these skeins into the work-in-progress category, even if the sock wasn't currently on my needles. I think that's fair. I started going through my stash one drawer, one cubby, one bin at a time. Every skein in my stash was touched and considered and then immediately placed in a sorting category. It took days to get through it all, and at times it was a bit painful to make hard decisions. When I finished sorting that final bin of yarn, I felt a total calm. I never changed my mind or regretted any decision I had made. I'd made huge progress. I ended up with an enormous pile of Category 1 yarns, the part of my stash that had to go. The smallest pile was Category 2, yarns for current works in progress. It was easy to assign these yarns. Either I needed that yarn for a current project, or I didn't. If there were works in progress that had been sitting for a long time, I ripped them out, wound up the yarn, and added it to the has-to-go pile. Category 3 was the hardest part of the stash to sort through. It was a trip down memory lane to look at the special skeins I had collected through the years. Many skeins brought back happy memories, ties to people, and knitting adventures. These yarns all had a purpose and meaning attached at one point in time. But hard decisions had to be made. In the end, I saved some of the special skeins I had collected, but not all. For example, a student in one of my classes had given me a skein of her hand-spun fingering weight yarn for me to knit socks, and the fiber was from one of my favorite indie dyers. This was a keeper skein for sure. Donegal Yarns had sent me two skeins of Studio Donegal Soft Tweed in the richest shade of pumpkin, all the way from Ireland, to use or review. These skeins will stay in the stash, and I will eventually design something wonderful with this treat of a yarn. Sometimes things have to stay with you. All the Category 1 yarns went to my neighbor. She does charity knitting through her church, and her group does fantastic work in our community. The yarns that I saved, they're now freshly organized, savored, and truly loved with new purpose. We all need to clean our stashes, especially ones that have grown to be unruly over the years. It frees up both physical and mental space, and that feels good. If you don't have a stash yet, or you want to start fresh, my advice is to try to be thoughtful and purposeful with your stash collecting. Most important, don't overdo it. Now, whenever I am tempted to purchase yarn, I think of my three sorting categories, and most of the time, I walk away. Being able to enjoy your stash will make you a better and happier knitter in the end. I've learned so much since my visit with Anne at the dreamy little knit shop so many years ago. She will never know the incredible impact those few hours had on me, my knitting, and my stash.
Work in Progress by Lilith Green. I can't remember a time when I wasn't aware of my body or how it appeared to other people. Anyone who grew up female will probably understand how it feels to be constantly bombarded with a stream of messages about the female body and its value, or lack thereof. Be thin, but not too thin. Be curvy, but not fat. Wear makeup, but not too much. Look feminine, but not too girly. Don't dress in anything dowdy or unflattering. Look sexy, but not slutty. It's exhausting, and it's everywhere. It's so pervasive that even the smartest women I know, myself included, fall prey to it. The first time I tried to lose weight, I set up a system of rewards that I thought would help me get to my goal weight. With each chunk of weight I lost, I bought myself something fancy. A boutique dress, a pair of high-heeled boots, expensive fitted jeans. The final reward for hitting my target weight was a new tattoo It's the only thing I still have, after, inevitably, putting most of the weight back on. More than 5 years later, I've realized what I was doing to myself. My subconscious rationale was that only thin girls deserve nice clothes, that nobody wants to see a fat girl in tight jeans or sexy boots. My rewards were actually punishments designed to shame me into staying thin. This is how the Western beauty system is set up. This is what years of programming do to you. You're not allowed to choose clothes just because you like them, or wear makeup because it's a fabulous color. If you're unlucky enough to have a body that doesn't conform to the restrictive, and frankly, ridiculous beauty standards, clothing and makeup aren't things to be enjoyed. They exist only to help you. Women's magazines, the diet industry, and fast fashion to the rescue. Hide your problem areas. Disguise your flaws. Just buy this beauty product, this makeup, this dress, this top. And if those don't work, buy some more stuff and keep buying stuff, and eventually all your body problems will be solved. Even when I started knitting and sewing, taking my first steps outside of the world of fast fashion, I still struggled. I did knit beautiful sweaters from gorgeous yarns for my partner, whose body type doesn't change shape too often, and whose broad shoulders look fantastic in hand knits. And although I managed to knit these to fit perfectly, the few garments I made for myself often ended up unloved and unworn. I had such a distorted view of my body that they were inevitably hugely oversized, or a style I didn't actually like, but that I thought would be suitable for someone my shape and size. I dyed luxurious yarns of every hue for knitters all over the world, but my personal stash had a lot of muted colors. Why call attention to my body with bright, bold shades? And a high proportion of sock and lace weight yarns. Socks and shawls will still fit, I reasoned, even if my weight changes, even if I'm fat. Over time, and over a few more years of losing and gaining weight, I could sense that my view of my body was gradually shifting. My partner was seriously ill for nearly 2 years before doctors worked out what was going on, and thankfully were able to help. The toll this took made me wonder why I was so worried about how I looked from the outside when I was lucky enough to have everything working properly on the inside. Watching Stephen West's knitting patterns develop and his more is more, less is a bore attitude toward color and style, discovering Sonia Phillips' 100 Acts of Sewing and her simply structured but amazingly beautiful fashion sense, starting online yoga classes with Jessamine Stanley, all of these things combined to help me forge a new attitude toward my body and a new direction toward making and the materials I used. When I first started knitting and later sewing, I spent hours browsing Ravelry, knitting blogs and sewing blogs, looking for photos of finished garments. Is it okay for me to invest the time and money into making this for myself? Did someone who looks like me knit or sew this already? How does it look on them? Is it flattering? Eventually, I realized what I meant by flattering was actually, if I make this, will it make me look thinner, younger, more conventionally attractive? Will it solve my body problems? But here's the thing that I've only just started to figure out. My body is not a problem to be solved. It has survived years of not enough food, too much caffeine, and too little sleep, otherwise known as university. It has gained weight and lost it and gained it again. It has acquired scars and tattoos, tan lines and stretch marks, wrinkles and freckles and gray hairs. It has fought off illness and healed itself from injury. It has slogged through a tough mudder, run for miles without stopping, walked a marathon. It is an incredible, beautiful machine that does so many things so well. And now, in its 40th year, I am finally teaching myself not to hate it. Not to love it either, not yet. But I am a work in progress, and one day I will. I will do this yard by yard with folds of fabric and strands of yarn. As I tuck fat skeins of wool in next to their sisters, I plot the thick cable sweater that will hug my slightly older and stiffer bones through next year's damp, cold winter. Bright, multicolored sock yarns will become simple socks to hug the feet that hold me up each day and bring some cheer to gray mornings. A precious skein of luminously hand-dyed, gloriously soft cashmere will become a luxurious, intricate lace shawl fit for a queen, which will most likely live on the back of my armchair to be dragged on over ancient pajamas against a chilly draft. In fact, I should probably sew myself some new pajamas as well. I fold away the washed linen that will become simple, loose-fit trousers, soft against the legs that have carried me safely and sturdily over so many miles. This bolt of strong corduroy will be a work jumpsuit slash overalls, completely unflattering and a complete joy to wear, that make me feel like Rosie the Riveter. The scraps of a vintage Superman bedsheet, the larger part of which has already been made into a super dress of power and confidence, are being hoarded for secret pockets or cuff facings, so I can sew superpowers into everything I make. And the shimmering vintage silk sari is taken out of my stash every few days to be unfolded and refolded, as I imagine the bias-cut slip or slinky dress it might become. There are some parts of my body that I struggle to love more than others, and I'm not ready to start this project yet, but I know it's waiting in my stash when I am. I stash for the body I have now and will have for years to come. Not for the body others think I should have, or that I think I should have, but this body, here and now. It will always have faults and flaws, weaknesses and whims, but it also has such strength, beauty, and power that it takes my breath away. It will always be mine, and I will enrobe it in as much splendor as I can muster. This is my body of work.
The Comfort Yarn by Rachel Herron. I'm not much of a stash person. Before you roll your eyes or sigh with disappointment, please know this. I've been a stash person. Boy, howdy, have I ever been one. I've had stash stacked from floor to ceiling. I've tried every single method of stash storage, and I've made some up. I've denied it. I've hidden it. I've thrown out receipts to avoid the shame, and I've done the opposite. I've left them out in the open, along the same lines as sticking an unflattering picture of yourself on the refrigerator. By nature, I'm a magpie. I'm a collector of pretty things. Given the right nudge, I could slip quite easily into hoarding, and I know that about myself, so I urge myself in the other direction. A few years ago, I read Marie Kondo's book, you know, the one about the magic of tidying up. You either hate it or you love it. There is no in-between when it comes to Con Marie. After reading it, I swung to the minimalist side. I looked forward to parting with stash, but I had no idea how much it would exhilarate me. Almost 3 years later, I haven't missed one single skein. Not one. That should come as comfort if you want to part with some stash, but worry about regret. I don't go window shopping much anymore. I don't cruise internet yarn stores. I buy what I need to make something when I want to make it. And that feels good. But you know what? I kept some. I didn't get rid of all my stash. I kept my sock yarn, because you always need to be able to cast on for another pair immediately. Cashmere, because if you need cashmere, you need it instantly. And handspun, because dang it, I don't spin that much, and the stuff I do spin I'm awfully and probably unreasonably proud of. Those are the reasons. But they're not the whole truth. The deepest truth behind why I kept a few small boxes of yarn is this. To feel safe, I need to have a stash for comfort knitting. In the same way you buy an extra sympathy card just to have around, I need to have comfort yarn close at hand. A few months ago, I got a phone call from one of my best friends. I can count on one hand how many times she's actually called me. We send texts. We email. We don't call unless it's an emergency. So I answered. I didn't recognize her voice. It was guttural, desperate. "My son," she gave a gasping sound, "has been killed." A car accident out on the winding coastal highway had killed her only child, 24-year-old Sergio Clor de Alva. On my way, my fingers fumbled with my phone. I couldn't seem to remember how to hang up. The only thing I needed in that moment was to be with Julie. I'm smart enough to know that my presence wouldn't fix a thing, but I wasn't going to breathe again until I was parked in front of her, one arm around her shoulders, the other arm protecting her from any further harm, as if anything could ever hurt her again. I didn't change out of my yoga clothes. I grabbed my keys and wallet. I was ready to go in seconds, and each one counted. The only thing I slowed down to get was my knitting. Nothing I'd been already knitting would do, of course. In a tragedy, I need something new, something I hope can hold, absorb, some of the pain. My ever-present socks wouldn't do. They were too thin, too fiddly. I couldn't work on the sweater I was making for my sister. There was no way I'd be able to concentrate on the arm's eye decreases. The softest yarn I had immediately at hand was a skein of blue merino lace weight. It wasn't wound into a ball. I grabbed a circular needle. I had no plan, no pattern. It didn't matter. I ran. Hours later, while making phone calls to the morgue and the sheriff's department, I unwound the skein. I draped the loop over the back of one of Julie's antique, mismatched wooden chairs. I listened to a nightmarish hold message from the highway patrol that seemed to never end. "Be careful on our highways. One lapse of attention is the difference between life and death. Never drink and drive. Don't be the person to cause that kind of pain to the ones who love you most." The fact that I was making a center pull ball, using my thumb as a nosta pinna, was the only reason I didn't climb right into the phone line to punch out the recording. For the record, toxicology reports showed Sergio had been under the influence of nothing but fatigue from the low-paid social activism job he loved. Winding the yarn allowed my brain a place to rest. Making a perfect center pull ball was productive, in a way that being on hold for hours wasn't. That night, at Julie's kitchen table, I cast on. The house was full then, dozens of Julie's closest friends filling the rooms with love and grief. One person sliced homemade bread. No one was eating, but at least she had a job, something to do. Another person went around refilling wine glasses. Yet another friend monitored Sergio's Facebook page, showing his mother the best pictures, the kindest notes. I cast on 40 stitches. "What are you making?" Kendall, usually quick with a bawdy joke and a cheeky wink, looked desperate for my answer. "I don't know." "Oh," disappointment flared her cheeks red. "Can I help?" I wish she could. I wish that Kendall could tell me what in the world I was doing with that yarn, but she couldn't, and I didn't know. I knit for a while. That night at home, I threw the knitting still on its needle into the closet, right into my dirty clothes hamper. It wasn't right. It hadn't helped. The next morning, I chose a ball of chunky gray wool that I'd bought at Stitches West. I'd planned on making a sweater out of the 1,200 yards I had of it, but that didn't make sense, not that day. I picked another needle and drove to Julie's house and spent the day making phone calls and trying to decide what to make with the yarn that suddenly felt too stiff, too sturdy, too rough. It reminded me of the time I'd knit while my mother was dying. I'd had the same problem then. No yarn was right. I finished a sweater, a copy of one she'd gotten in Norway in the 60s, at her bedside, and I was left with empty, desperate hands. She lived 5 hours away from my own stash, so I went to the local yarn shop in her town, a store I'd never visited. The women working there reminded me of my friends at home. I didn't tell them why tears were running down my face as I wandered the aisles touching the skeins, but I bet they had a good guess I needed yarn therapy in a bad way. Suddenly, unable to face color or cheer of any kind, I bought 4 skeins of dark black yarn, an alpaca wool blend that felt as heavy as my soul. Later, in my mother's room, When people asked what I was making, I said it was a prayer shawl. "How sweet," they said. "She'll love that." I knew, though, that it wasn't for her. It was for me. The things I tucked into each stitch were my hopes, my unanswered prayers. I knew then I'd never finish the shawl, and indeed I didn't. When Mom died, I didn't even finish the row. I bagged the project. Years later, I gave it away to a craft reuse shop. It didn't feel good to knit it, and how could it have? Here's the thing. As makers, we fix things. That's what we do. It's our superpower. We're good at it. When it comes to grief and loss, though, there's no fixing. No wonder our stashes can seem so powerless in those times. There is no magic skein of Cormo that will fix our brother's cancer. There's nothing on two sticks that can ease radiation fatigue. But our stash isn't for them. It's for us. It's how we show up. And there's nothing more important than just that, being present. Having the right yarn at hand at the very worst times is how we get there. While we helped Julie plan Sergio's services, the house stayed full. People sat in every room, and so many of them had wide stares, fidgeting hands. Some people cooked. Others dropped cartons of coffee and donut deliveries and ran. Chris did the dishes by hand. He refused to let even a single glass end up in the dishwasher. I had my knitting, and I couldn't imagine not having it. With it, I could sit still. I could meet every gaze as my fingers kept moving. I could converse. More importantly, I could listen as the stitches moved in my fingers. Without my knitting, I don't know if I would have been brave enough to stay. I might have run away, helpless, like so many other people who came in and out of the house. Without anything to do, people ran. Knitting, in grief, gives me bravery. It's my armor. Am I giving you permission to bolster your stash with more yarn? Hell yes, I am. This is the only time I'll advise you to stock up. Buy it without a plan. Stash it in a box that pleases you. Mark it if you like. Comfort yarn. The actual yarn you buy is inconsequential. It can be a $70 ball of cashmere or that soft $2 baby yarn from Michaels. The only thing comfort yarn should be is soft and pleasing to both the hand and the eye. Stripes or soft gradients are nice, giving your gaze a place to rest, but they aren't necessary. Nor do you need a pattern. In fact, I'd argue against one. Connecting the printer and casting on a certain precise number of stitches and getting gauge can be too stressful in these times. Just cast on using whatever needle you think might work. Knit a while. Purl if you feel like it. Do a little seed stitch. Change your mind, pull it out, and start over. Do this 10 times. Then 10 more, if it helps you sit and be present. As a product knitter, this is the one time I'm only about process. I do not care about the end product, not one little bit. I spent last weekend with my mother-in-law, who's dying slowly of a painful disease that we can't stop or predict. Packing at the last minute, I threw in 3 fat skeins of yarn I'd spun on my wheel the month before. On the circular needle I brought, I cast on 1 by 1 rib. I knit a short, fat scarf, because that's what it turned into, until I ran out of yarn. On the plane home, I did a half twist and joined the ends with a 3-needle bind-off and ended up with a cowl that will always remind me of the coffee shop where we all sat outside and pretended everything was okay when it really, really wasn't. The fact that it actually turned into something was just a side effect. In the sun next to my mother-in-law, I held my yarn and needles, and I was able to just sit. To be. To breathe with her. Makers are doers. We're often not content to just sit with open hands and watch life pass by. We have to get up and accomplish something. Anything. Put us in front of a television with nothing in our fingers, and we'll manage 6 or 7 minutes before we're off the couch and searching for something else to do. At Julie's house, I finally ended up knitting with stashed red cashmere. I knit a square and made it into a long rectangle. I didn't need it to be anything. My knitting couldn't fix her pain. I could do nothing. In grief and loss, it's often true that there's nothing we can do, We can't fix it. We can't change it. The only thing we can do, and by far the very best thing to do, is to show up again and again. You arrive and sit and stay. There is only so much puttering and card moving and flower arranging that can be done before you sit and look at the person you love, the person in pain. With soft yarn in your hands and no plan beyond moving this stitch to that needle, it's easy to stay. So yes, go shopping. Tragedy happens to all of us, and while I hope it's decades before it happens to you, I urge you to fill that box. And I recommend cashmere.
A Proper Stash by Christine Vehar. From a very young age, I've had an astute understanding of what constitutes proper dress attire. My grandmother didn't wear pants or athletic shoes. A knee-length skirt and white Keds were okay to prune the roses. Other than that, it was a uniform of dresses and skirts paired with Oxford shirts made from cotton, preferably with a touch of polyester to help control the dreaded wrinkle. Permissible colors were neutrals, periwinkle, and every once in a while, a fuchsia-colored blouse for just a pop of color. The overarching message? Look your best without calling too much individual attention. Belonging was of key importance. I spent my summers with my grandmother, learning to sew and knit, and I grew to know her circle of friends, many of whom were prolific quilters. Each quilter's home functioned as her own private gallery. The bed, a stand-in for the museum wall, displayed the main work of art. Sitting on a bed topped with a handmade quilt was a crime akin to shoplifting or swiping a couple bucks off the top of the donation basket passed during Sunday Mass. Quilts were a combination of performance art created in a group and plein air art, not to be touched, only to be looked at, with the women of the house acting as security guards, protecting the household Van Gogh. These quilts would be passed down to future generations, always with the hope that generations to come would also stitch their own quilts, adding to the collection. Because my grandmother gave such attention to her choice of dress, since early childhood, I have been keen to people watch with specific attention to the way people wear and style their clothing. It should come as no surprise that when I traveled to India years later as part of a study abroad program, I would be drawn to a community of women who also have a very astute idea of what constitutes proper dress attire, and also have an intense custom and history of stitching. In India, it is common and stylish for Hindu women to wear brightly colored saris, but the Rabari women in the Great Run of Kutch, a desert region in the northwest corner of India, wear primarily all black, and they do not wear saris. I was drawn to them immediately. Their daily outfit is composed of an ankle-length skirt, a blouse with elbow-length sleeves, and a very large, woolen, rectangular headscarf worn just over the crown of the head, cascading down over their shoulders to just above the back of the knee. Sometimes, bright, colorful embroidery, speckled with tiny mirrors, dances across the front of a blouse. Seeing the Rabari, words that come to mind are regal, modern, striking, and beautiful severity. The Rabari's unusual and distinctive style of dress made me curious to know why and how it came to be, and to learn more about their textile traditions. Was this an adaptation to their environment? Did the Rabari stitch together like my grandmother and her friends? Did they create textiles other than what they wore? Their style of going outside of the norm led me to believe that this type of independent thinking would reflect in their other textiles too. Over the course of the next 2 years, I met many Rabari women. I interviewed them about their textiles, and this is what I learned. Historically, the Rabari spent hours, sometimes days and nights, roaming the desert with their cows and goats, a camel trailing at their side, carrying their belongings and sometimes a child or an elder. When they weren't walking, the women stitched. Rabari women sewed all of their own clothing, along with their children's and most of their husbands. They embroidered their blouses and headscarves, and they appliqued larger utilitarian objects, like bags and quilts. Embroidery is a popular pastime throughout the Great Rana of Kutch, where many people find themselves in living conditions similar to those of the Rabari. To embroider and applique, only small amounts of materials are needed, a small and portable stash that suits their nomadic lifestyle. Such materials are lightweight and easy to carry, which is important when covering hundreds of miles on foot through the desert. Where money is saved in the realm of materials, time is spent to create elaborately decorated textiles, especially in the case of the Rabari. To set themselves apart and recognize one another from far distances while walking in the desert, the Rabari develop their own distinct style. When they embroider, they create flowers, mandalas, and curving, flowing borders to tie it all together. Their appliqué takes a pictorial form, depicting elephants, flowers, and peacocks. Motifs, in combination with a specifically chosen color palette and set repertoire of stitches, like the commonly used chain stitch, are what define a quintessential Rabari textile. Just like my grandmother's desire to belong, the same holds true for a Rabari woman. Her textiles form a bond between her and her community. The day a Rabari woman is married is the most celebrated event in her life. For the wedding, a ceremonial camel blanket would be made. Unique to the Rabari, this piece looks like a rectangle where the four corners have been elongated, with tassels made of scrap fabric attached to each end. A quilt would be made for the bride and groom to sit on. As part of her dowry, the woman would make bags to carry her belongings, including that stash of embroidering materials. If the family she was marrying into lived in a house, she might make wall hangings too. She also would transition to wearing a special wardrobe of clothing, signifying her status as a married woman. There are three groups of Rabari who are defined by where in the desert they live and by the subtle differences in their embroidery and applique. They are the Kachi, Vagadia, and Dabaria. As I traveled around the desert, I began to notice stacks of Dabari Rabari textiles and clothing for sale. This was unusual. It was rare to see a Rabari piece for sale, most having been tucked away for safekeeping. These stacks of textiles had the finest, tiniest stitches I had ever seen, and these stitches covered the entire surface of the fabric. The combination of stitch and color made the motifs come alive and nearly dance off the pieces. Of the three communities, the Dabari Rabari created the finest textiles. But why were these for sale? I looked around and noticed that no one in the Dabari Rabari community was stitching at all. Then I learned why. Stitching had been banned. Remember, textiles are important to the Rabari, and they play a significant role in the wedding ceremony and how a married woman dresses. This collection of textiles is actually required in order for the marriage to take place. As it turns out, the Dabari Rabari women had been taking an extraordinarily long amount of time to finish their trousseau, purposefully creating very tiny stitches because it meant they could delay their marriages. While this led to the creation of exquisite textiles, it was not sitting well with the overall community. The husbands' families became upset, filing complaints with the elders who act as the governing body. They wanted their future daughters-in-law to come and live with them sooner. This began happening so regularly that the elders finally decided to ban all embroidery and appliqué. If a Rabari woman was caught stitching, she would be fined nearly $100, a financially devastating amount. The elders meant business. After asking a few more questions, I began to understand what was really happening. Historically, the Dabari Rabari community has had an intricately hand-stitched textile-based dowry and a bride price, namely, an amount of money that must be paid to the bride's